I'd like to introduce Beth Savage. Beth is an artist working with performance and installation. Her work examines social ecologies and human nature relationships. She's undertaken major residencies with Camberdown Wildlife Centre in Dundee and the Nottinghamshire Wildlife Trust at Attenborough Nature Reserve, where her research has focused on human encounters with wildlife and links between industry and nature. She's exhibited widely across the UK and internationally and has recently completed an MA in Fine Art at York St John University. She's a founder of Performing Now, an open platform for performance art, and a member of the Wild Project, an international group of artists responding to ideas of wildness. All right.
Thank you. Okay, so as the notion of the Anthropocene takes hold, conservation of non-human spaces becomes increasingly important as a resistance to the homogenization of space for human use. So following two long-term residencies at conservation sites, a nature reserve and a zoo, my research has led me to question the role that arts practice plays in mediating human non-human relationships. Although these sites are thought of as spaces for animals or for nature, they actually operate within a dominant paradigm of utilized human space. These sites are highly curated according to the principles of their own specialisms, aiming not only to conserve species, but to make nature visible and to promote their conservation message through encounters with nature. However, these aims are diminished as spaces such as these become part of a leisure economy, which means that the public often fail to engage critically with these sites. This paper reflects on my own experience of making art with conservation spaces during these residencies, as we've said, at Camberdown Wildlife Centre, which is a small zoo in Dundee, and Attenborough Nature Reserve, which is a former gravel quarry in Nottinghamshire. So they're both kind of quite close to cities, and often these spaces are really the only encounters that people inside the city have with anything beyond sort of squirrels and seagulls. So since applying for this conference, I've also started a PhD in order to continue this research in more depth. So I welcome discussion, reading recommendations and feedback. And as I begin to find my feet as an artist researcher, this paper is going to reflect on some of the ways that the works that I made during these residencies operated in order to hopefully open up some avenues for further investigation. So the analogy of the zoo as gallery speaks to a time when conservation was not a priority and zoos were a spectacle, an exotic menagerie to show off wealth and to entertain the masses. Increasingly, zoos and nature reserves are once again part of this economy, and the zoo as gallery perspective has returned, although perhaps it never left, with all of its negative connotations. Now, though, increasingly zoos are taking a position that encounter can be a catalyst for change, and they aim to educate their visitors rather than just provide something exotic to look at. Although I think this was a bit of a contentious point inside the discussions. So this is a position which I agree with. I agree that encounter can be a catalyst for change. However, while at Camperdown, one of the problems that was expressed by staff, and which I observed myself, was that visitors came to see, but did not seem to engage. They would move through the zoo as though they were ticking animals off a list. And it didn't really seem like a very fulfilling or transformative encounter. I also became increasingly disturbed by how comfortable I found being in the zoo. The family fun atmosphere that they were trying to cultivate was really seductive. And also, you know, got to hang out with with cute animals and very charismatic creatures. So it was quite a difficult thing to try and stop myself from just falling into. It was easy to see how the conservation message and even the animals as living beings in themselves may become lost or invisible to the visitors as they enjoyed their day out. The problem is that if zoos are truly tools for educating people about conservation issues, then they should be critical spaces rather than purely entertainment. So architectural theorist Jane Rendell states that sites in situations that are outside of the gallery, art can adopt more critical functions, and works can be positioned in ways that make it possible to question the terms of engagement of projects themselves. So public artwork that's critically engaged works in relation to the dominant ideologies, but at the same time questions them. By examining conservation spaces through these types of artistic considerations, perhaps we can disrupt current experiences of animal encounter, So here are some images of me attempting to do that in the zoo in various different ways. I'll kind of talk a bit more about some works in a second. So we can perhaps disrupt the current experiences and radically alter the anthropocentric entertainment role that the conservation spaces are taking up. Mark Dion has a little-known work at Camp Down, which examines how our relationship to bears has changed over time. So the bear rock was built as part of the redesign of the bear enclosure in 2005. So this structure references not only an old form of Scottish building, but also the original bear pit that is still at Camp Down. Although obviously there are no animals in it now, it's still a really interesting feature of the history of that zoo. Inside, Dion replaces the traditional interpretation panels with various references to the changing ways in which we relate to bears. From a bear skeleton that could be from a natural history collection, to a kind of cabinet of curiosities, which includes images from explorers' photographs, cuddly toys, and sort of images of toilet roll mascots, and various different ways that we adopt the imagery of bears now. However, like the animals themselves, this work is somewhat assimilated into the context in which it sits. The entertainment mindset seems so connected to our experience of zoos that this work becomes just another novelty, and just another kind of interesting place from which to catch a quick glimpse of the animals. So in my work at Camp Down, I was trying to address this type of assimilation through performative works. So with no budget, having just graduated from university, and sort of, blagged my way into this space. I also was kind of working with an audience of predominantly young children and families. So I employed a visual language that I hoped would be familiar to young and old alike in order to introduce complex discourse around rewilding, which is what I was looking into at the time, to the zoo visitors. So I used simple costumes made from pipe cleaners and fabric and wool to make family-friendly performative interventions, which explored various captivities, various perspectives on captivity, freedom, myth, and fact. So some of these works ask the visitor not only to observe, but also to participate, to have a shared experience, and to reflect on that experience. So this work is called The Intergalactic Wanderer, and so this entailed a walk through the city, starting from the Lynx enclosure in the zoo, and walking to the observatory, which was kind of out and up a hill in Dundee. So in order to undertake this journey, I mapped out the shape of the Lynx constellation onto a map of Dundee, and that was the route that we took. At each star, I marked the road in chalk and read a short text that informed the discussion during the next leg of the journey. So this work not only sort of referenced the idea of kind of the animal leaving the zoo, it also looked at the myth and symbolism of the lynx, and more historical kind of importances that have been forgotten about this animal. The further from the animal that we moved, the less concerned with the reality of the lynx the conversation became, until we reached the observatory, and it was really talking about the symbolism of the animal. So another one of these works, Werewolf, which also incidentally is the most puns I've ever been able to cram into one title, consisted of me turning myself from a sheep into a wolf while sort of sat opposite the wolf enclosure, while simultaneously planting a forest habitat for my return to the Scottish wilderness. Each wall tree included a fact or discussion point which related to the main conflicts that were being raised by the reintroduction proposals, mainly around the safety of people and livestock. So visitors could read these and they could choose to replant them and continue to allow this forest to grow, or they could take them away and continue their own discussions on the pros and cons of rewilding. These performative works acted to create a spectacle which disrupted the visitor's experience and introduced these contentious issues in a non-confrontational way. The visitors could choose to engage or not, but those who did had a very different encounter than they were used to when visiting the zoo. These works broke the spell of expectation. This was something odd, very unusual to encounter in a zoo, which asked the visitors to be curious again. And many literally asked, "What's going on here?" which I felt was a very pertinent question, given where we were. So these live works also seem to reassert the aliveness of the animal somehow. And whether it was a kind of realization of your own presence in the presence of a live animal, I'm not entirely sure that's something which I'm quite interested in looking. So Dion described his work as a space for humans, a delineation which occurs throughout the zoo. So for example, the map at Camperdown not only served to direct visitors, but also to very clearly outline the human spaces and the animal spaces. Apart from a few exceptions, for example, there were peacocks that were allowed to kind of basically roam wherever they wanted, and of course keepers who enter the enclosures at various times for feeding, there was a very kind of strict rule that the animals stay in the animal space and the humans stay in the human space. Any transgression of this rule is actually a major event, as was kind of evidenced by the gorilla that escaped from London Zoo, from its enclosure in London Zoo, and the whole place was put on lockdown to sort of prevent any real contact from happening. And of course, the case of Harambe, the gorilla in Cincinnati, who was shot after the child fell into his enclosure. These cases were quite interesting because they sparked a kind of social media frenzy. And alongside the memes and trolling and abuse and everything that comes with this platform, there were public discussions about zoo practices occurring in a way that they don't necessarily always occur. So when the usual viewer exhibit dynamic is altered by transgressions of these delineated spaces, the animal becomes visible once again. At the zoo, the fence is the primary site of encounter. It's the meeting place between the human and animal space, both permitting and denying access to the animal. The fence also acts to set up an audience-exhibit relationship and signals a viewing space from which the animal is expected to be accessible. Shannon Jackson's essay, Performativity and Its Addressee, examines the role of the spectator in performative works. It also throws up an interesting question about the role of the animal in the zoo. So in a passage examining the durational performance installation, which is entitled Naked, from Aiko and Coma, she writes, "In November 2010, visitors to the Walker Art Center perambulated as usual through its gallery spaces. They lingered before paintings and circled around sculptures, eventually happening on a gallery that housed an enclosed room. Upon entering, visitors found leaves, rocks, water, and minerals. They might have discerned a tremor in a small pile of leaves, looked twice at the pile of what appeared to be a stone, before realizing that the structure also contained live bodies, two of them. With barely perceptible movements, Aiko and Coma lay prone in what might have been defined as an ecological art piece, never fully still, but not exactly moving either. Poised precisely to prompt awareness of the precarious nature of aliveness itself. When asked to discuss what it was like to perform this signature work, they said that the hardest part was not the length of time or the discomfort of being gazed on by strangers, but the peculiar hollowness of moments when they were alone. As Aiko notes in the epigraph to this essay, the absence of the spectator brought no relief, but a strange tenuousness. It was as if the work, waiting to be seen, did not quite exist without anyone there to witness it. So there's a parallel dynamic which is created in the zoo between the observer and the observed. While the animals themselves presumably do not have the same tenuous feeling when there are no visitors around, like the artwork, they are meant to be encountered. Their role is to be visible and the accessible face of conservation. So is the animal in the cage like this artwork, waiting to be seen, and only activated by the presence of the viewer? Jackson goes on to assert that the viewer is a co-creator of the encounter. And it's in this notion that I sort of found maybe the reason why performance works and why it seems to provoke more critical engagement. When the animal is presented as an object to be seen and the zoo is experienced as a place of entertainment, it is far easier for the viewer to play this passive role. They are satisfied by seeing the animal and do not engage in the co-creation of encounter. By disrupting the entertainment mindset in a way that highlights the aliveness of the animals, they become active in their role as observer, and the zoo becomes a critical space once again. This disruption may be as dramatic as an escaped gorilla, or it could be as simple as encountering a woman in Pipe Cleaner Wolf ears and asking, what's going on here? So when I began my residency at Attenborough, I soon discovered that there was a different dynamic. So here the human-animal space delineations were, they were still there, but they were less defined. The animals were free to live there. They kind of lived there of their own accord. And obviously, you know, there was a lot of space management going on to encourage specific species. But the majority of visitors seemed actually very engaged. And they would bring their binoculars and bird books and even sort of wear khaki-coloured clothing in order to help enable considered encounters. However, there was an interesting phenomenon that was occurring. As nature reserves improve visitor facilities, they're building things such as cafes on site, and a coffee culture is emerging, in which increasing numbers of visitors come to the reserve purely for the cafe and don't necessarily engage in the wider conservation aims at all. So the reserve was really keen to find a way to reach these visitors, and so I sort of half commissioned and set out to sort of figure out some way of engaging them a bit more than they were. So I started out by holding coffee and, this is a hard one, conservation conversations. Again, I'm a bit one for a wordplay with the title. Seeking to find out more about this group of visitors. What I actually discovered was that they felt they had very little knowledge of nature, and so they felt that the spaces weren't for them. They felt uncomfortable to enter into these spaces, either through a kind of fear of needing specialist knowledge, or because they sort of felt out of place amongst bird watchers and nature lovers and didn't really feel it was their thing. So this led me to consider ways in which I might be able to bring these voices back into a discourse of conservation, and maybe encourage them to feel a bit more part of this space. My approach drew on Nicholas Beaureard's notion of relational aesthetics, which puts forward that instead of clay or paint, dialogue, social relationships, and space created by gathering people together is what constitutes the artwork. Relational works acknowledge intersubjectivity and allow meaning to be shaped collectively by those involved in the experience of the work, rather than in more of a kind of individual response to an object. So this social turn in art is gathering pace as artists explore issues of social injustice and kind of play with the boundaries between art and activism. Relational works are becoming increasingly common in gallery contexts, as well as in community and site-based art practices. In these works, the artist often functions more as a facilitator rather than as a maker. So to me, relationships seem to be at the heart of Attenborough. There were the relationships between the humans and the animals, between wildness and control, between nature conservation and the industrial activity that had formed the site, and between those who felt that they had knowledge and those that felt that they didn't. Because of this, a kind of relational work seemed to make sense. However, I also wanted to find a way that these types of co-created relational works could continue to function without the presence of the artist facilitator. So I collaborated with ceramicist Becky Ridsdale to create a tea set, which would act as a point of reference for conversations about conservation. We also wanted to bring in about the kind of heritage of the site and the industry, so we looked at policy and all sorts of things and became quite involved. So there's a mix of native and invasive species which adorn the plates. Neither one is kind of elevated above the other, they're all just kind of interspersed. It's not really signposted, we haven't named them or anything, it's just kind of, these quite sort of, I suppose, general images that you might encounter. So also the peeled back layers, which you can just see on that image, revealed some text that related to environmental policy and information about the industrial activity at the site, again, to sort of act as a reference for people who maybe didn't feel they had that knowledge. These layers also created a precariousness to the experience of using the tea set. As people negotiate how to eat from this oddly shaped plate without sort of losing their food or breaking the sort of delicate pieces off, it seemed to kind of highlight the precarious nature that we are in trying to kind of conserve. So the teacups are decorated inside with a diagram of ponds, kind of relating back to what I remember from childhood science textbooks. And the more tea that is drunk, hopefully, the more layers are revealed and the deeper the conversation gets. So although I've yet to hold a full event with this tea set, those who have encountered this work at exhibitions and test runs found that they actually knew more than they thought about the animals and issues presented. Or they found that having something concrete to respond to allowed them to be confident in the questions that they were asking. These dialogic objects act as prompts for engaged conversation. They allow for relational works to continue even when the artist facilitator has left. And although, of course, meaning may be read into them in the more traditional kind of object viewer sense of art in an individual way, they also have this relational capacity for co-creating. When you sit down with your friends, even if it's just, oh, you know, this cup is a bit strange, what's going on here? You know, you start to generate conversation about the animals that you're seeing and what you know. So as I've explained, I'm embarking on a new period of research in this area, and this paper is a starting point. And the writing of it has been a really interesting exercise in reflection. But what has become clear to me from these reflections is that much of the discussion that is happening in artistic and curatorial discourses is actually incredibly relevant to conservation practice. As an artist, I have freedom to explore ambiguity, contradiction, and conflict in ways that a zoo or nature reserve may not be able to do practically. Perhaps art can open up spaces of encounter that are beyond the reach of conservation spaces. By offering an alternative perspective, critical art practice could help to create a radical shift in the way visitors encounter animals at these sites, and perhaps even provide an alternative space in which to rethink the nature of encounter. So I'm sort of putting forward that hopefully, if art can kind of create these spaces, then maybe the idea of a zoo as gallery doesn't need to either be quite such a negative thing, or perhaps we can kind of do away with that need that is being kind of expressed, because there will be alternative places in which to encounter animals. Thank you.